If your knees check the weather before you do, time to check out Joint Relief Institute. Fast, FDA-approved pain relief covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000 as in zero pain.
60 years ago tomorrow, a career criminal here, homegrown in Illinois, named Richard Speck, tortured, raped, and murdered 8 student nurses in the south side of Chicago in a townhouse. I'm going to say their names: Gloria Jean Davey, Valentina Passione, Merlita Gargulo, Nina Schmali, Pamela Wilkening, Suzanne Ferris, Mary Ann Jordan, and Patricia Matusik all died at the hands of this monster. One nurse, Corazon Amaro, survived by hiding under a bed. It shocked the nation. It happened in 1967. He was sentenced to death, but eventually the Supreme Court commuted his sentence to life in prison. And now with us to discuss this case, over the last 60 years, it just doesn't go away. I want to know who he is, got him to commit these crimes, what kind of background did he have, and what was the fallout of this episode. And with us to discuss this is noted author and journalist Dennis Brio. His cover story on these murders were published and won an award for exemplary journalism. He is a graduate of the Northwestern University Medill School of Journalism, and his definitive book is called Crime of the Century. Excellent, excellent book, and really sums everything up. Dennis, thank you so much for joining us. Hi, Dennis. Welcome to the show. Okay. Dennis. Hi, Dennis. Welcome to the show. Is Dennis there? Nope. Okay. See if you can get him on again, Tony. Let's just talk a little bit about the fallout. And I wanted to mention this. I posted on Facebook this morning that I was going to do this segment, and I had so many comments, and it was just amazing that people were saying, my mother was best friends with one of those nurses. Somebody tended him in the prison, who was related to me. We never camped out again after this happened. I lived right down the block and worked in a diner where he just had dinner the night before. So you have all these people in the city of Chicago who were affected and will continue to be affected by this story. And I have had some criticism where people say you should just leave this alone. It was a terrible crime. But I do think it's worth it to talk about these types of crimes, because they do result in different things that happen in the legal justice system. And certainly in this case, when Richard Speck was in prison, it did cause all kinds of things that changed our system. Dennis, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here, Karen.
Great. Okay, so your book, Crime of the Century, wrote it all about Speck. And let's start at the beginning. Can you tell us a little bit about who Richard Speck was?
Well, Richard Speck, it turned out, was actually, he was a career criminal who was born in Illinois, and he was in Chicago for no better reason than he had fled two states. He was on the run from the law. He'd been arrested at the age of 24, 41 times in Dallas, and he got on a bus and came to Chicago to stay with his older sister who lived near Wrigley Field. She'd been a pediatric nurse before she married, but she and her husband got tired of Speck after a few weeks, and they wanted to find a ship for him to sail on, and they took him to the National Maritime Union Hall on the south side of Chicago, 13 miles south of the Loop, and in the hopes that he could find a ship.
Okay,
how he got to Chicago.
That's how he got to Chicago. But, you know, he was born in a little town called Kirkwood. It's like near Galesburg, or not too far from that area, if you know where that is, listeners. Tell us a little bit about his family upbringing, because, you know, you try to, nothing will explain what someone does when it comes to a crime like this, or the John Wayne Gacy's or the Dahmers of the world. You see backgrounds of all types. You see terrible backgrounds, and then you see not so terrible backgrounds, and, you know, you can't really make sense of it. But tell us the salient points of his upbringing that you think might have contributed to him becoming who he was.
Well, it is an interesting case. Richard Speck was the seventh of 8 children, and his mother came from a strong church background and raised her children to be disciplined, God-fearing teetotalers, specifically teaching them that alcohol was even. What happened to Speck was his father, to whom he was very close, died when he was 6 years old, and his mother, proving love is blind, married an alcoholic lunatic she met on a train, And this stepfather hated Richard Speck, told him many times he couldn't stand the sight of him, refused to adopt him. So Speck had no father figure and turned out to be the bad apple of a very good family with a sterling reputation. And he, in time, began to ape his stepfather's drinking and went from there. And, of course, had a terrible life in down in Texas in the Dallas area before he came to Chicago.
And the father, the stepfather, he and the stepfather came to blows. I mean, it was a violent relationship. And there's one in particular that I think we should talk about, and that has to do with the hammer. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about this assault that happened between Richard Speck and his stepfather?
Well, Speck threatened, broke into his father's gun cabinet. They did hate each other, and I'm not familiar with the hammer, but if it relates to brain damage,
yes,
and whether or not that, you know, that was a cause of his criminal activities, Bill Martin, the prosecutor, was emphatically against that line of reasoning.
And there are other books, you know, really talk about this episode where the stepfather took a hammer and hit him in the head really hard. I mean, really, like, cracked his skull and the whole shot, and that he suffered from headaches for the rest of his life. Again, I'm saying this not to excuse him at all, but I do note, and I don't know, you know, I've kind of studied serial killers over the years. It just seems that so many of them have had really serious traumatic brain injury, which, again, can affect your ability to be empathetic, which can affect your ability to have impulse control. I'm not saying that's a cause and effect, but I thought it was an interesting piece of his history, his really sordid history, actually. But again, I understand why the prosecutor here doesn't want to give him any reason to do what he did. Go ahead.
Well, more to the point, I mean, Speck was evaluated by six eminent psychiatrists and neurologists as part of the, pretrial skirmishing between the prosecutor and the defense. And these experts found Speck to be absolutely sane, competent to stand trial, and no sign whatsoever of brain damage. And that is, you know, pretty conclusive. So
yeah.
Whatever it, you know, and there was a risk that the jailhouse physician who had become close to Speck was Mike testified that Speck had a, quote, organic brain syndrome, which Bill Martin, the prosecutor, thought was absolutely bogus and was prepared to demolish him at trial if it had come to that, but the defense never called him. But the prosecution's point of view was the serious predictor of violence is a history of violence, and Speck had a rich history of violence.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We've been getting so many texts and so many comments for people who have been touched by it one way or the other. I'm going to get to a few of them. But I've got a 847 texter, Dennis, who's asked the question, you know, if he hated his stepfather so much, why, and he apparently loved his mother, why did he kill women as opposed to men? As if you can explain that, but what is your best answer to that?
Well, I think Speck hated society. You know, he'd been a failure at, you know, the real tests of maturity. You know, he failed at school, failed at employment, failed in marriage. He had a growing hatred for the world, and I think he just found women to be easier prey. The many psychologists who interviewed him, they said that Speck would fight a man at any time if he had a knife or a gun, but when unarmed and sober, he couldn't face down a mouse. So I don't think he particularly, there's any one answer in why he might have had a rage against women, but he clearly had a hatred against society and women, including these eight nurses he killed, he viewed as easy prey. And he had rehearsed his crimes over the years, and, it was horrific what he did on July 13, 14, 1966.
And we'll get to that in a minute. And I guess my question is this, knowing what you know about him, if you were to have run into him and had interactions with him prior to these crimes, what would you note? What was his salient personality like? There are different serial killers like the Gacys of the world who were braggarts and loud and gregarious. My sense is that he wasn't that type.
Well, he was clearly a bragger. He was on the surface, he was friendly and ingratiating, particularly if he was drinking. Often when he wasn't drinking, he would be very subdued and surly, and, you know, many people viewed him as a, you know, good old boy. But, I mean, Speck had an IQ of about 85 to 90, which is low normal for an American adult. The psychologists who evaluated him after the murders, and there were many, estimated his emotional mental age to be about 10 to 12 or a pre-teenager.
Wow.
So this was not a typical, you know, typical American adult. And he was when drinking, and he was usually drinking, he was prone to violence. But again, only if he were armed. And in fact, one of a woman in Michigan, in one interlude when he had an emergency appendectomy up in upper Michigan and actually spent some time, not romantically, but just as friends with one of the nurses who had cared for him, she asked him why he always carried a switchblade and why he was always flashing it. And Speck said, well, because I'm chicken to fight with my hands, that's why. And they actually spent, believe it or not, 8 or 9 hours on a deserted beach in the Upper Peninsula one time, and Speck was a perfect gentleman, did not make any romantic advances, did not threaten her. But so he was complicated, but by the time he was in Chicago, he had a rage against the world. He was looking for an outlet, and, you know, he hit Chicago like a, you know, violent thunderstorm.
Right. And is it true, or is this just an urban legend, that prior to him coming to Chicago, he had been, you know, he'd spent time in Texas, but he had been in the central Illinois area and had been suspected of killing a woman named Mary Kay Pierce, and he fled from that area to Chicago. Is there truth to that?
Absolutely. He, when he left Texas after his 42nd arrest, which would have sent him back to federal prison, he came to visit with his sister and her husband, and they promptly sent him off to his relatives in Monmouth, which is the town right next door to Kirkwood, which is kind of a village that time forgot. And he worked about 7 days as a sander of plasterboard, but then he checked into a hotel, hit the saloons, and he probably killed a woman down there with a violent kick to the stomach, a barmaid who he followed from bar to bar, even though they did not charge him with that crime. And he also executed his signature rape of a 65-year-old widow who he broke into her home, told her to strip naked or he would kill her. And she suggested and said that they hold hands and maybe pray. And Speck had his way with her, and he took her house coat and took his pocket knife and slashed it into strips, and he blindfolded her. He tied her hands behind her back, and he tied her ankles, which is exactly what he would later do with the nurses. And when she finally, the next morning, was able to get the blindfold off and work off her ankles and went to a neighbor naked with her hands still behind her back, the neighbor had to use scissors to cut those knots. They were tied that tightly. But, yeah, he definitely, in Monmouth, Illinois, and the police chief, and where he had a brother who had a sterling reputation, was a good friend of the police chief. When they finally ran him out of town, he left town just ahead of the law and returned to Chicago to his sister who lived near Wrigley Field.
You know, it's interesting that you note that his family wasn't a bad family. I mean, despite the fact that the mother remarried somebody who wasn't maybe an optimal husband, to say the least, she did raise them with morals and raise them with religion and raise them not to drink. Was he just an anomaly in the family? Is that what you're thinking? Or is that kind of what the thought is, the common thought?
Well, he clearly was the bad apple of a good family. His four older brother and his two sisters had absolutely sterling reputations, did not drink, were good, honest citizens. But Speck fell in at an early age. He fell in with, he left school, he dropped out of school at 16. He fell in with an older crowd who loved to drink and fight and collect tattoos and loose women. And he lived that life, and while Bill Martin was learning how to be a prosecutor and Corazon Amaral was learning how to be a nurse, Richard Speck was acquiring a Ph.D. in criminal cunning, usually break and entry, and he had the cunning of a born liar and a career criminal, and he just was, you know, that helped explains what happened.
Would you, and I looked at some of the literature, and I'm sure you read a lot more than I have. Was he diagnosed? Was he a sociopath? I mean, he must have been, right? There's no other way that, I mean, that must have been at least part.
Yeah, I think the psychiatric panel diagnosed him as a sociopath with alcohol, but that doesn't even begin to describe how evil he was. I mean, I think at the end, the description of him as a snake, as one reviewer referred to the book, and she just said, Speck was a snake, and we shouldn't be surprised that he, bit people and injected his venom. But, yeah, he clearly was a sociopath, psychopath, whatever word you choose. He was evil incarnate, and Bill Martin said of all of the, in his career as a prosecutor and defense attorney, of all the people he represented, all of them had at least some redeeming quality, and Speck was the one exception who had absolutely no redeeming human quality.
Kind of seems like it. We have just about 2 minutes here, and I want you to just set up where these nurses were living, where in the city of Chicago was this townhouse, and who was in this place. We've got like a minute and a half.
It was the south side of Chicago, 100th Street, 13 miles south of the Loop, a mile and a half west of the shipyards. Shipyards in Chicago, which were full then with, three ships, the shipyards and steel. And Speck was there because he was at the National Maritime Union Hall trying to find a job on his ship, either for the Great Lakes, some of them went as far as Vietnam. The nurses were there because the South Chicago Community Hospital had a dorm shortage, and they had put about 25 nurses in three boxy little small townhouses right across the street from the Maritime Union Hall. And so that, just strictly by chance, and a real collision of cultures, you had the nurses across the street from a union hiring hall where a deranged apprentice merchant sailor like Speck had 3 days to observe his prey, and whatever thoughts bubbled through his mind, it led 3 days later to his crime.
Let's take a break here. We are talking to the author of the book Crime of the Century. His name is Dennis Brio. It's a very good book. If you're interested in this crime, please read it. You can get it on Amazon. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about the crime. If this is something that is triggering for you, I would suggest that you turn down the volume. I know some people are triggered by these types of things, but I want to get the picture of what happened, and I really want to focus on the wonderful woman who survived the attack, Cora Amaral, who, by the grace of somebody, was actually saved from this horrible crime, and I want to talk about where she ended up and what she's doing now. So we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking more about the Richard Speck murders here on the Karen Conti Show on WGN.
Lindholm Roofing has appointments available now to provide you a complete roofing, siding, gutter, and tuck pointing inspection. Call 773-283-7675 or lindholmroofing.com. Tell them that Lou sent you. Lindholm Roofing, their family has your family covered.
We are talking to author Dennis Brio about the horrific crimes that were committed 60 years ago tomorrow, and that is the Richard Speck murders in the south side of Chicago, where he killed 8 student nurses. Dennis, let's talk about the crimes. The scene is the south side townhouse where nurses, these student nurses were rooming. Can you tell us what exactly happened and what attracted Speck to this particular place?
Well, Speck had been right across the street for 3 days in the union hiring hall, so he'd had plenty of time to see the nurses coming and going in the hospital jeep. The hospital was a mile away. And so on the night, about 11 o'clock on the night of July 13th, he broke in using a screwdriver and went up to the second floor bedrooms and knocked on the door of Corazon Amaro and Valentina Passione, who had just said their prayers and had gone to sleep. And when they opened the door, Speck flashed his .22 caliber gun, which he had just stolen the day before from a barfly. And it was the first gun Corazon had ever seen, and he said, "Where are your companions?" He then herded the two of them back into the back bedroom, which had 3 nurses, and Nina Schmale was in the adjoining front bedroom, and she came in. So he had 6 nurses, and what happened was Speck was very soft-spoken. Corazon thought he had gentle eyes. He assured the women he was not going to rape them. He just wanted to get money for a trip to New Orleans. And they all sat down like a little Indian powwow with Speck and the 6 girls, and he would keep clicking the gun at them to count them, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And they made the mistake, the Filipinos, there was no friction between the Filipinos who were working exchange nurses and the three American nurses who were in the townhouse at the time, but they were not very close. The Filipinos had seen rough characters before. They wanted to fight for their honor, but the American nurses, who'd all taken Psych 101, convinced them that they had a drunk on their hands and they were going to humor him and usher him out the door. So Speck sat down and assured them he wasn't going to cause them any harm. He just wanted money to get away, and the nurses got up and each one would walk to get their purse, and they'd give him $5 here, $6 there, and of course Speck would keep counting them, clicking with a gun. And while he was doing this, he got interrupted twice when one of the nurses, Suzanne Ferris, came in to, their house mother was in a nearby adjoining townhouse, and curfew was 12:30. They had to report in, so she reported in and called the house mother. Had she heard any noise upstairs, that might have stopped the whole thing. And Tammy Sukoff, who was on the phone with her boyfriend wanting to get bread for a sandwich, and came over to the nurse's townhouse, rang the bell. Speck heard the bell, and he actually had the six women in single file with his gun in their backs walking down the stairs to check it out. By that time, she had left. And then he took him back upstairs, and then when the seventh nurse, Gloria Davis, came back from a champagne dinner, she'd just become engaged, and she was a little tipsy on champagne. When she came in and came up the stairs and knocked on the door, Speck was somewhat startled, opened the door, stuck the gun in her chest, made her sit down. And by now, Speck is getting a little nervous with these interruptions, and he proceeded to take out his pocket knife and slash the bed sheets, and very politely asked the nurses if they would just put their hands together, and he tied their hands very, very tightly. It's the same with their ankles, with double professionally tied knots, and they were, at that point, totally helpless. And then what happened, he had seven nurses, and then he took one of them and walked her from the large back bedroom up to one of the front smaller bedrooms, and he gagged her. He had her spread eagled on the floor. He was about to rape her when Suzanne Ferris and Marianne Jordan, who were in the townhouse down the alley, and they were going through bridal books because Suzanne was going to marry Ann Jordan's brother, Phil. And when they came up the stairs and they saw their classmate spread eagled on the floor, it was, you know, the game was kind of up. And they fought. And Speck, who did not, he had a gun, he didn't want to fire and make any noise. He just ruthlessly lashed out with his pocket knife and stabbed and strangled them with their own nylon stockings and brutally killed them in a matter of minutes. He killed these three nurses just like that. And from that point on, he was basically eliminating witnesses, and he was on automatic pilot, and kind of the engine of destruction was in full movement. And after he killed one nurse, he would go to the bathroom and wash his hands so the next victim would not see blood on his hands. And that's how it followed, how it happened, because the nurses were absolutely helpless. And Speck had the run of the house, and it proceeded from there.
So there was a ninth victim, Corazon Amoureux, and she hid under the bed, and she therefore saved herself. Why was it that he didn't notice that she was down there?
Well, she was under the bed in the large back bedroom when Speck, just a few feet away, was raping Gloria Davy, and she had to, pray to God and, close her eyes and, grit her teeth and get through that. But then Speck took Gloria Davy and went down the stairs to the living room, and he was gone for about an hour. And during that time, Corazon managed to somehow crawl across the room and get from the bed she was under to get to another bed, which had a blanket hanging down, and she could kind of hide behind that blanket. And that's where she was when Speck came back, and he didn't know how to count, apparently, because he missed her, and he kind of turned the light on and looked around the room, and he picked up one of the nurse's pocketbooks and jiggled it, took a little bit of money, and threw the pocketbook and actually almost hit the blanket that Corco was hiding behind. But just by that, she was a sneeze or a cough away from being killed. But 3:30 in the morning, Speck walked out of the townhouse, and Corazon managed to call to her, crawl up to her front bedroom, crawl up on a ledge, open the window, go out, and scream, they're all dead. All my classmates are dead. And that was a scream that, you know, shook terror into the heart of Chicago.
Let's finish up this segment about Cora, because she fascinates me. I met her at an event in Forest Park, and she just seems, she's got such a peaceful way about her. My guess is that this terrified her and terrorized her for the rest of her life. She testified heroically against Speck. Dennis, where is she now? Do you know where she is and how she's doing, and what the rest of her life looked like after this horrific crime?
Yeah, she was absolutely the key figure in the book. She was absolutely critical to the conviction of Speck, you know, getting a death sentence. It only took the jurors 49 minutes. But Bill Martin, the prosecutor, was very worried because Corazon was under tremendous pressure. And Bill talked to a psychiatrist friend who said, because the nursing supervisor wanted her to go back to work, she was afraid she'd make a mistake. Life and Look magazine were offering her tremendous amounts of money, like $100,000, to fly her mother and cousin to Chicago. And this was a girl who'd grown up dirt poor and sent half her salary back to the Philippines. And she said, no, I will not accept a penny. I just want to redeem the honor of my classmates. But Bill was worried that, and he'd been warned by the psychiatrist, you can't be too kind to this woman because she could lapse into psychosis or situations where she will absolutely forget what happened. And Bill spent, it was 4 months before he would formally interview her because he was so afraid that he might lose her as a witness. And had she gone back to the Philippines and the Philippine consul general was claiming that she was held hostage, Bill, in effect, had to kidnap her and put her into the witness protection program. And first he took her to a resort up in Highland Park, and then he moved her into an apartment in the city in Lincoln, the Lincoln Park neighborhood of Chicago, where she had in an adjoining suite 24/7 police protection. And but she was very fragile, and she was absolutely critical. And when she got to trial, and Bill walked her through what happened that night, and she was described by court reporters as one of the best witnesses they'd ever seen. She went through exactly what had happened that night. And then when Bill said, do you see the person who did this in the courtroom today, thinking she would point her finger, she opened the gate, she stepped down, she walked over to within a foot of Speck, pointed her finger at his pockmarked face, and said, this is the man. At that point, the reporters ran for the phones, and Speck was as good as convicted.
I want to hear the end of the story briefly about Cora and how she's doing currently and what was her life like after this horrific crime.
After the trial, Bill Martin facilitated her permanent move to America, and she and her Filipino husband live in Virginia. She was for many years an intensive care nurse at George Washington University, and her husband was a realtor and immigration attorney. And Corazon is still living in Virginia. She's very happy. She has 2 children, 6 grandchildren. And over the years, up to 100 extended relatives joined her in Virginia. And she says she wakes up every day with a smile on her face and gives thanks to God. And one little detail, she and her husband bought a vacation home in Las Vegas, and she would occasionally go into casinos and play penny ante poker because that's what her police bodyguards would play when she was sequestered in protective custody all those many months. And she doesn't play for much, but, you know, win, lose, or draw, she always has a smile on her face. And until Speck died in 1991, she did have nightmares about it. She really couldn't relax about it until she knew he was dead. But she has lived a very full, happy life, and it really is kind of the triumph of good over evil. And when we get to the Curtis tapes, Speck hit absolutely rock bottom with that performance.
Let's just quickly, I have a text, if you could just quickly answer this question. Can you ask Dennis what Speck's defense was at trial?
The defense was they went with an excuse that a husband and wife saloon couple were willing to testify that Speck was in their saloon at the time of the murders. It may have been a case of mistaken identity. For whatever reason, they volunteered. They would have offered. It was an alibi defense. And it was obviously the jurors thought absolutely nothing of it, since they gave Speck the death sentence within 49 minutes. But that was the only defense. The insanity defense had been ruled out when the Blue Ribbon psychiatric panel had ruled that he was sane and competent to stand trial. And the other hope they might have had would have been if the jailhouse physician had come to court and testified he had an organic brain syndrome and couldn't control himself. But the psychiatrist had demolished that by saying, and you know, in their examinations, that Speck was, you know, absolutely did not have any brain damage. And in fact, the night before he went to kill, he was playing pool in the shipyard inn and he ran the table. I mean, he was not in any kind of a drug haze. He was perfectly competent. And Corazon, who was used to working with drunks and alcoholics and people under the influence of drugs, observed Speck for hours, and she testified that he was absolutely, his movements were normal.
Dennis Brios here with us. He wrote Crime of the Century. Just quickly, the death sentence was commuted to life because the Supreme Court in the 60s basically said that all the death penalty statutes in the United States were faulty and everyone had to retool their death jury instructions and the like. So that's how, on a kind of a technicality, he got commuted, and that's why he lived out his natural life in prison. But let's talk about, we only have a few minutes here, but Dennis, to your knowledge, how did he spend his time in prison, and how did it come to be that Bill Curtis went into the prison, got videotape of him, and for those of you who have not seen it, it's on YouTube. He basically was developing breasts as a woman. He was doing drugs. He was engaging in sex. And he was just, you know, completely obnoxious about his crimes and lack of remorse. How did he spend his time in prison, and how did it come to be that that is what happened to him?
Well, the inmates were running the asylum, basically, and Speck was a house painter in prison. Once his death sentence was changed, he was spared by the Supreme Court. He was moved from a special unit into the general Stateville population, which was controlled by the black gangs. And some people thought, well, Speck degraded himself by, you know, and of course he had access to hormones and cocaine and marijuana and homemade wine and whiskey. But what he really did, and it was Bill Martin and Bill Curtis called in Bill Martin to make sure that the person he had on tape was actually Speck. And Bill went through the transcript of the Curtis interviews, and in our book, he analyzed what he thought when Speck was telling the truth, when he was bragging, when he was lying. But the punchline was he absolutely confessed to the crimes, because these inmates were making a kind of a 60-minute interview type. It was made in 1988, and it was given to Curtis in 1996 when he ran it during television sweeps weeks. But it was sent out for hopes they thought there might be a book. It was basically to pay an attorney's bills who were representing some of the gang members who ran Statesville. And that didn't work out. And it was given to Bill Curtis, who, of course, took it to the Illinois legislature for reform of the prison system.
Dennis, but, who took the film? That's what I don't understand. I mean, getting cameras into a prison is, you know, is very difficult for journalists, impossible for lawyers.
Well, that shows how the inmates had total control of the system, because they had the total time to, in effect, set up a studio. It was one of Speck's gay lovers was right with him, and Speck was snorting cocaine off the man's thighs. And another one of his lovers was asking the questions as if he were Mike Wallace from kind of, you know, off stage. And they had it filmed. They had a camera with excellent audio, and they actually filmed the full, however long it ran, hour, 90 minutes of this tape. Yeah, it sounds incredible, but they ran this full thing, and Speck went through a lot of bragging, but he absolutely, when his interrogator and lover off to the side said, "Did you kill those nurses?" He said, "Sure, I did." And he said, "Well, are you crazy, or why did you do it?" And Speck said, "Well, it just wasn't their night." And he added that if you're asking me if I'm sorry, the answer is no. And if you're asking me what I felt, just like always, I felt nothing. And Bill Martin, the prosecutor who got a death sentence, thought that Speck, that was his confession, which really tied everything in a knot, because they previously had circumstantial evidence. He was on the scene near the nurse's townhouse. They had physical evidence. They had 10 points of identification on fingerprints he left on the back door to the south bedroom. They had Cora's devastating eyewitness testimony. And they had the consciousness of guilt that he tried to run once he realized he'd left a survivor. and he got a cab, and he relocated from the south side to the north side. And, of course, then he connected with some Skid Row derelicts, and he tried to convince them to help him hop a freight train to Dallas. And when the police superintendent, Orlando Wilson, actually went on to the newspapers and said, this is the man, and ran a photo of Speck, and it was on the front page of the Tribune and all the other Chicago papers, Speck then, at that point, he broke a bottle of wine and cut his wrist. He didn't do as effective a job on himself as he did on the eight nurses, but he probably would have bled out had one of the inmates not called the police, who came, took him to Cook County Hospital. And Leroy Smith, the physician who had been reading the Tribune story and about his emblematic tattoo on his arm, born to raise hell, noticed the tattoo, and Speck kind of woke up, and he was asking for water, water. And Dr. Smith said, did you give those nurses water? And that was it. And then they put out a 211, and the police cars swarmed, and Bill Martin showed up to type out the arrest warrant, and, you know, that led to the investigation and the trial.
This is it's hard to listen to, and I do think that this crime, as many of the other horrible crimes that have been committed in Chicago, Gacy included, really have just changed people. And I'm reading texts, and too bad I don't have time to read a lot of them here, Dennis, but a lot of them, like, we grew up with the boogeyman. We grew up, you know, hearing about this. My friend lived in the house next door. My friend, you know, worked next door over here. We weren't able to go out after school because of this crime. So it changed a lot of things in Chicago, and I think it's a crime that's worth talking about for that very reason. And people like that exist in this world, whether we want to believe it or not. Dennis, thank you so much for joining us. I'm going to, again, promote your book. It's a great book. Dennis Brio wrote Crime of the Century. There's another book that I would like to recommend, Extraordinary Care. And it's an interesting book about doctors who have given care to various people, including Adolf Hitler, Howard Hughes, Elvis Presley, and many others. And maybe next time you come on, Dennis, we can talk about that book. Okay?